Why don't we do this? We'll read our passage this morning, so if you can stand, we'll read it together. We're in the Gospel of Luke, Luke chapter 19, 45 through the end of verse 8 of chapter 20. Starting in verse 45, chapter 19. Jesus entered the temple and began to drive out those who were selling, and saying to them, "It is written, and my house shall be a house of prayer, but you have made it a robber's den." And he was teaching daily in the temple, but the chief priests and the scribes and the leading men among the people were trying to destroy him. And they could not find anything that they might do, for all the people were hanging on to every word he said. On one of these days, while he was teaching people in the temple and preaching the gospel, the chief priests and the scribes and the elders confronted him, and they spoke, saying to him, "Tell us by what authority you are doing these things, or who is the one who gave you this authority?" Jesus answered and said to them, "I will also ask you a question, and you tell me, was the baptism of John from heaven or from men?" They reasoned among themselves, saying, "If we say from heaven, he will say, why did you not believe him? But if we say from men, all the people will stone us to death, for they are convinced that John was a prophet." So they answered that they did not know where he came from. And Jesus said, "Nor will I tell you by what authority I do these things." So the goal is, one of the things I think we would say is to be able to understand what is this passage talking about, some of the details. But I think here's another goal. We've got the overarching theme. We've got the march to the cross and really the empty tomb, resurrection. But even as we understand all of these things, there's something else we sometimes want to ask, because one of the things we're going to see, this has to do with worship. And when we think of worship, I think sometimes we have a tendency to just, well, that was back when there was a temple, and that's the way it used to be before Christ came. But understand there's a principle we can take away from this, and I want to do that, and we'll see it right away in this first section. So the first section that we read both, obviously, is there were problems with worship in the temple. And if we look at verses 45 and 46, we notice that Jesus drives out those that prey on worshipers, pun intended, if you understand kind of what he quotes from. But one thing we understand about Luke's account here is more summarized than in some of the other Gospels. In Matthew, for example, Matthew 21, we're told that the people doing business were there, and there were also those buying and selling, those selling doves, and money changers that were in the temple. And so what Jesus is doing is he's coming in here, he's very vocal, and he's going to move the business out of the temple courts. Now, when we think of the temple, let's get a precursor of everything that's going on. I'm going to try the little pointer, see if it works. So can you see that? You may not be able to read the word, and that's fine. That's General's Courtyard, Gentiles, would be us. So if we were coming into Jerusalem, let's say at that time, we would be identified as Gentiles. We could only go here. We could not go in here. And of course, only the high priest goes into the Holy of Holies. So where the commerce is happening is within this courtyard. And the reason I bring that out is to give you a visualization of what's going on. Certainly, it's a larger area. But you think about this. The only place that Gentiles can go is right there, where they've set up business. Then there's the court of women, beyond which women couldn't go, the court of Israel, beyond which laymen could not go, and then the sanctuary, beyond which priests could not go, and the Holy of Holies. But this place where all these merchants were at, this outer court, and by the way, like we mentioned, Matthew provides more of the details of all the specifics of what was going on. On the one hand, it looks like, oh, they're providing a service. But on the other hand, it's like, no, it's little more than service. It's business. So start with, we talked about buyers and sellers. Now, if you read in our account in Luke, what does it tell us? It tells us that he just began driving out those who were selling. But as we mentioned, there were buyers and the sellers. Now, what's interesting about buyers and sellers? What's going on here? Well, think about if you're making this pilgrimage to Jerusalem, which Jesus was part of a group that came in during the Passover season, and you were required to have an animal for the sacrificial temple offering, supposed to be without blemish. If you're poor, there were other things you could do, like as we get into the doves. But here they have, in the court of the Gentiles, animals that are being sold by merchants and bought by pilgrims that didn't want to bring an animal on the journey because they would not know if it would be approved by the high priest. So here's the other thing, too. You could possibly bring the animal and it would be deemed, well, it has a blemish, you can't be sacrificed. But look over here. We got our handy-dandy service here. We'll provide an animal. You just pay the money. Pretty good deal for those that are selling. And here's the other thing is, you consider this, and this is like a common human sinful trade, I guess, is the way that I would put it. Who is allowed to sell in those courts? Well, you have to have approval. Who are you getting approval from? The high priest and those of that hierarchy that are going to allow you to be in that temple court. Just guess what would probably have to happen. You're probably going to pay a fee. You're probably going to do something to be able to do that. So what's interesting is, this is God's temple. This was the standard of worship. And it's corrupted to begin with. So we're told very, very clearly, not necessarily, Luke's doesn't tell us is in details Matthew, but Matthew tells us he drove out both the buyers and the sellers. And you might say, well, that doesn't seem exactly right. Well, I could see the sellers, but what about the people buying? Well, you contribute to the problem. Because here's the reality is, you're really supposed to take something that, like this animal that you have raised, and it's like the best of the best that you've got, without blemish. You know a year ahead of time, by the way, this is going to happen. And if you know a year ahead of time, you should be able to plan ahead. And be able to, if maybe buy another animal or exchange for another animal for the sacrifice at the temple. And some people, to be honest with you, didn't want to travel with the animal. So that would be easier for them. Which is interesting, because you think about, this is for what? Worship. This is worship. What's the easiest thing we can do for worship? It's kind of this mentality. I think that's the reason why Jesus didn't just drive out the sellers, he drove out the buyers. There were also, though, we are told in Matthew, money changers. So there was always a temple tax. So the money changers were always there as well. And the temple tax was patterned after the command in Exodus. And so it was a payment of a half shekel, half a day's wages. It was to be a memorial for the Lord making atonement and used for the religious services. It was expected that the currency would be exchanged into the closest currency to the Hebrew shekel, because a lot of times foreign currency was deemed unacceptable. Why? Well, a lot of times it'd have idolatrous images, so you can understand that. It's estimated, too, that there's probably about 13 money-changing tables that would be in that court. I know, by the way, when you change the money, it's going to, you know, it's like ATM fees, right? 10 to 12% was added to exchange the money. Now, just using those two examples, of course, there was also, Matthew talks about doves, selling of doves. What does that do to worship when you come? You know, I remember the first time when you started hearing about, like, you go to Walmart or whatever, and they'd have a Starbucks in there. Wow, that's kind of different. Well, now you go into some stores, they've got food courts, smaller version of a food court. They got one-stop shop. You go to Costco now, you got tire service, you got pizza and hot dogs. That's about it. They got a number of different things you can get there, and slushies, I think, maybe. Just the healthy stuff there at Costco, right? But you have a number of different things. So it's like your one-stop shop, and it's kind of foreign, but that's exactly what is happening in the temple. The temple wasn't designed for that. Pretty sure we go back and we read through, that's not really the specifications on how to set up the temple for worship to God. So what does Luke tell us? That he tells us enough of what matters. He doesn't include fully, but he talks about that phrase in verse 46, "And my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a robber's den." It comes from Isaiah 56, 7. That's what that outer court was designed for, was for worship, a place for prayer, the place for non-Jews to pray and worship God. And what have you turned it into? Because let me ask you, have you ever had a garage sale in your, someone down the street from you have a garage sale, and you ever notice there's a lot of traffic, a lot of noise? It's not peace and quiet. You want to go out and have a cup of coffee in your front porch, and all these cars are driving by, walking through your yard to get to the garage sale. It's not really nice and peaceful. It's a lot of commotion. Now imagine animals and people selling animals, buying them, the commotion that's going on. Can you imagine those conditions for worship? It's noisy. It's busy. It's just, it's kind of a little bit chaotic. So it ruins the whole point of worship on what's going on. And by the way, is there not places elsewhere in Jerusalem you could have done this? I mean, you think within all of Jerusalem they couldn't find another place to set this up outside of the temple? I personally think some of this is kind of a slam against the Gentiles coming into the court for worship. It's that disdain for Gentiles. But what is it robbing God of? That's the issue. What does it rob God of? It robs God of worship. And Jesus is God. And he comes in and he lets them know, you have messed this up. It is robbery. It's a money-making venture. Oh, by the way, includes extortion to be able to sell. So here's what you have going on with this. And so Jesus clears them out. The other gospel accounts are more descriptive, but he drives them out. He makes his point. They are out of there. So then also that's included in this section in verses 47 and 48 are some of the other actions that are deemed a threat to those that are in authority. So it tells us once Jesus has arrived, because you have the triumphal entry, Luke tells us, and then immediately we see him going, the picture is going in, driving out those that are in the temple, and then he begins to just teach on a daily basis. And that is even a bigger threat, actually. Because as Jesus teaches, he's basically teaching against the system that's set up for worship. Now think about this. This is all in light of the fact that here we are arriving at these really last days that are coming up for Jesus' life. And we're told by Luke, even though he knows the timetable is coming to a close, he continues to fulfill the mission to teach people. Really, by teaching them, it's preparing them for really the gospel. And by the way, it's going to make the leaders in Israel even more upset and ready to find any way to destroy him. It just further cements it. In fact, the Gospel of Mark tells us that when Jesus interrupted the commerce, it just continued to fuel the anger as well with the teaching. So the picture is all these people, leading men among the people who are trying to destroy him, that is the leaders, the lay leaders, everyone who is in leadership does not care for Jesus at this point. Because he has not allowed this system to continue. He wants it pure worship. But yet, here he is, every day. You're going to find him. I'm right here, coming in to teach. And they can't destroy him. Why? Because the rationale is people are listening intently to what Jesus is saying. They revere his teaching. If they try to grab Jesus in the midst of his teaching, what's going to happen? It's going to be an uproar. They're afraid of what's going to happen. By the way, the other thing is, if there's an uproar in the temple, there's commotion, the Romans get involved. It's not a good thing if you're a Jewish leader for several reasons. Number one, you could be out of your leadership. Number two, the Romans could come in and they could not really care about the Jewish people and injure, maim, kill people in the midst to stop the chaos. So they really don't want to do that. So here's the point of application as we look at really what's unfolding, right? And we think about temple worship, right? Well, you know that scripture that talks about our worship? We don't have a temple that we go to, not a physical temple, but what does it tell us? Where is the temple now? Me. 1 Corinthians 3:16, do you not know that you're a temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? So here's a question. Let me just ask you. What would God say about the worship going on in your temple? What is in there that's distracting from really worshiping? What is it? I mean, you can say, oh, I don't have money tables inside of me. I know you don't. But what's the essence behind those money tables? Is it a lust for money? Is that crowded into your heart from what should be worship for Christ? What is it? What is it that takes away from your worship? That's you know, I mean, Jesus flipping whatever you have, whatever idol you have in your heart, whatever thing you have in your heart, if he wants worship, you think he would be fine with something else that allows to crowd into your heart, your mind, that takes away from worshiping him. I don't know what that is, but you'd know and God knows. And Jesus would want to come in and just drive that out because Christ wants to be at home with the things that are in your heart, that are in your mind, that you covet, that are important to you. So we've got this picture, and then the other thing we're told is the confrontation in the temple. This is an interesting interaction, right? So it says on one of the days, so we're told as he's teaching them, the conflict really comes to Jesus. And it comes in the form of the leaders that are considered the authority. By the way, they set this temple up. They're there. They come in. They're not happy. They can't grab him, but they're going to challenge his authority. How are they going to challenge his authority? Well, they're going to, number one, we're told they approach him while he's in the middle of teaching. So they interrupt the teaching. They didn't wait. They weren't polite. Oh, he paused. Maybe we can talk. Somehow they interrupt him. It's very clear. By the way, in front of the people that are listening, we're going to pull the power card. Ha ha, we're the authority. So Jesus, who's given you the authority? In fact, really, he asks them two questions. Because they disagree with what he's been doing, they're going to imply he's not been given authority to do what he's doing. And so they ask two questions that have a purpose, right? So the first question, I mean, in one sense, if I look at them, right? Tell us by what authority you're doing these things. Or who's the one who's given you this authority or gave you this authority? But they're similar but a little bit different. I think one addresses the kind of authority that you possessed. Were you like the authority of a rabbi? Are you a prophet? Who are you? What are you? The other question deals with who do you represent? Who represent yourself? Do you represent a group? So again, I think both those are two different questions that are addressing a little bit two different things. So the questions are, you know, what's the deal with this authority? So here we read, now Luke is, like I said, it's very succinct. But he asks a question and you think, well, he's not even addressing what they said. But in reality, if you think about Mark 11:29, would be where you would see the fuller extent of how he said this. Jesus said to them, I will ask you one question and you answer me, and then I will tell you by what authority I do these things. Now Luke just gets right to the chase. He says, I'll ask you a question and you tell me. But what this is, what he is doing is, it's actually a common method of rabbinical debate. And it's a counter question, but it's a method really to look at presuppositions. in an argument so that you can get to the heart of the matter. I mean, maybe you've had, I mean, you're not speaking as a rabbi, but maybe you've had a conversation where you want to stop and say, "No, wait a second. He doesn't love me." Well, okay, hang on. Define love for me. What am I asking that person? Before I ask you or address that, tell me what you mean by the word love, so I can understand what we're talking about. Only what Jesus is saying is, he wants to understand, if you're going to question my authority, I'm not just going to go to, I'm really going to get to the heart of the matter. What do you do with John's authority? Because if you won't recognize John's authority, we're going to have a problem, right? So he asks this direct question because this question involves the baptism of John. It says, was the baptism of John from heaven or from men? He's talking about the baptism, not just that John was doing, but I think in particular as he baptized Jesus and recognized his authority. And that's what the question, it's a direct question. Did John do it from the authority from heaven, meaning from the authority of God, or was it just another man just baptizing another man in the body of water? Did I mention that John the Baptist was not liked by these men either? He had a fond expression for him, which I wouldn't recommend using unless you're wanting to create enemies, a brood of vipers, a bunch of snakes. Why are you out here for baptism? He says, What? Let's see some fruit in accordance with repentance. Let me show me that you really feel bad about what you're doing. That I mean, feel bad in the sense of you want to change something. Show me that. Because they came out to check it out. They came out as skeptics. They didn't come out because they really felt like we're really ready. We've got a problem. There's sin. We are prepared for the Messiah, which is what John was doing. So these guys are smart, right? So actually we're told of the deliberation within this. So as we're told, it says they reason among themselves, saying, if we say from heaven, he'll say, why did you not believe him? But if we say from men, all the people will stone us to death, for they are convinced that John was a prophet. So they have a conundrum in giving an answer. On the one hand, if they admit John's story is from heaven, what does it look like they're really questioning? By not recognizing that a prophet recognized who Jesus was, right? You're questioning God. On the other hand, they say John acted because he's just a man, man-made authority. The crowd is not on board with that. And you know what? They're motivated by the fear of man rather than the truth. Fascinating is every time Jesus responded, even when he got in front of his accusers, never was the case. Leon Morris, when he talks about this section in his commentary, said there had been no prophet in the land for centuries, and John had come in the tradition of the ancient prophets, calling everyone back to repentance and the seeking of forgiveness of all their sins. Many had responded, and it is clear that even those who did not do this were impressed by the man. Almost everyone would have agreed that he was a prophet, and how could anyone speak of a martyred prophet by this time, obviously, as from men? So this is the conundrum they're in. What are they going to do? What are they going to do? Well, I guess they didn't really want to see what it was like to get stoned to death. So they come up with this brilliant answer. We don't know where he came from. Oh, that solves it. Okay, great. Really, what's fascinating is it tells us something, though. Their lack of an answer tells an answer, right? Because after all their indignation about stuff, and we're about authority, and we're supposed to be the ones in authority, right? They're Israel's leaders. They are responsible. You know, it's kind of like a pastor to default on the question about what does the Bible say about something and say, especially about major issues of salvation. Oh, I don't know. Isn't that what you're supposed to be known? Aren't you supposed to talk about how I get a relationship with God? I don't know. I mean, I guess if you're Unitarian, that works, but not if you claim to believe the Bible. And here, these are Israel's leaders. They're responsible to evaluate the claims of professing prophets. It's always been that way in tradition in history. And they can't answer the question, is John really a prophet or not? Because that's really what the question is. Did he have authority to do what he did? But they have an answer. They're just not going to tell it. They're just not being truthful. Because they don't want to really expose what they really believe. So Jesus responds, he's not going to answer them either about his authority. Jesus knows that since they don't answer in front of the crowd, they look foolish to continue arguing with him about his authority. That's really what the bottom line here is. And some may say, well, is he avoiding the question? He's not avoiding the question. He's dealing with these leaders, and in truth, he's presenting them with a dilemma that really exposes their hearts. They don't really want to know. I don't think there would be ever a time where it would really would be considered okay by some of these that would consider themselves to be evaluators of all things related with the truth and the law to just have an answer of, I don't know. They're the experts in the law. Some of them. All they really care about is they don't like Jesus, they reject his authority. That's all they really care about. When it comes down to basically the gospel, when you talk to people, you're really talking about two things. What difference does Jesus' authority make for you in your life? It's that way if you're going to come to faith in Jesus, because you've got to get to the point you are powerless, you're a sinner, and you recognize that it has kept you from God. That's the one thing that's kept you from God. And you can't, under your own authority, change that. But I can look to one who has a greater authority to do it for me, to forgive me, and that's Jesus. And put my faith, my trust in Him. The other thing is, then when you come to do that, what authority, what difference does that make in your life today? Because as I look at some of the younger folks, like Corey and I, and Kelly, Scott. No, when I look at young people, it's like at some point in time, you're out from the authority of your parents, right? But at some point in time, you're going to live under somebody's authority. And when you profess to know Jesus, what authority really makes a difference in your life? Do you really believe the things God told you? Do you really believe it? Because I'm going to be able to tell you whose authority you take for seriously. And that's the thing here. The authority is questioned and it should make a difference. These guys don't really accept his authority, but they can't even be honest about it, right? What's fascinating, though, is when Jesus goes into that temple and kicks everyone out, there's enough recognition of his authority that we don't read about this giant struggle going on. He runs them out, and the fact that they've interrupted their commerce, and these authorities, as the Gospel of Mark tells us, were upset about that, in particular, tells us he was successful in getting them out of there. Now, I don't know for how long, but they were gone for that day. So even people who weren't real happy recognized his authority when they came in. But as it comes to us, and I think just the application is, as people who profess that Jesus Christ is our Savior, do we recognize his authority as the Lord of our life at all times? Because if we do, there's decisions we have to make in life that are not easy. And they don't go away, I don't think. I think every time we face a new situation, a new part of life, you know, you think when your kids are little, oh, once I just get them to 18, then we're good. No, they're not. Or some of you who have grandkids think, oh, can't wait to have grandkids. It's all going to be an easy street. Don't have to stress or worry, right, Barb? No, that's not the case, is it? You have different stages in life. And by the way, with those different stages, you know, you're interacting with family and with people that are close to you. New things are going to present dilemmas, trials, whatever. You're going to have to figure out. I have to make this decision. I've got to figure something out in my life. Who's really my authority? Because I may have to make some tough decisions, but I know what, if I believe Jesus is my authority, then I may have to follow him in an area that I know is right. It's not going to be easy. And I think that's where we take away from this, and we see Jesus' authority on display, and we see those who just outright reject it, but they can't even be honest about it. And then we see those even that struggle. But you know what? The one thing is, I was even thinking about those that are embarrassed, right? I seem to recall a man by the name of Peter who had the same problem. He really couldn't tell the truth about being a follower of Jesus. And then Jesus approaches him after he's resurrected. And Peter is ashamed. He's weeping. And Jesus restores him. In fact, he gives him a charge, feed my sheep. Feed my sheep. And that's the thing is, God is gracious with us, even when we aren't following him like we should.